James?
Invincible's underway for Zinc.
Where are you,
sir? Oh, Moneypenny. I'm just up here at Oxford, brushing up on a little Danish.
Little?
I'm afraid you're going to have to kiss off your lesson, James. We've got a situation here at the Ministry of Defense. We're sending the fleet to China.
Uh-huh. I'll be there in an hour.
Make that 30 minutes.
So that means good.
You always were a cunning linguist, James. Don't ask. Don't tell. James, have you brought me a souvenir from your trip? Chocolates? An engagement ring?
I thought you might enjoy one of these.
How romantic.
Hmm.
I know exactly where to put that.
Oh, Moneypenny. The story of our relationship. Close, but no cigar.
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Ten, nine, eight, seven, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition. 2, 1, 0. We have a liftoff. We have a liftoff, and it's lighting up the area. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center. The Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
Hello and welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Books in association with the Earth Station One Network. It's one long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture. I'm Van Allen Plexico. Today we present part 5 of our 6-part retrospective on the James Bond film series, The Pierce Brosnan Era, tonight. And joining me to discuss these films is my regular co-host on the AU Wishbone podcast and my semi-regular co-host on this program, John Ringer. Welcome back aboard the show, John.
Thanks for having me, Van. Very excited to talk about James Bond again.
Yeah, we've got one more to go after this one, and we'll be caught up until Spectre comes out later this year. So maybe we can do a show just reviewing that movie in a few months. I'm looking forward to that. But tonight, we're going to hit on the 4 Pierce Brosnan movies. I've made no secret all along in this series that he's my favorite Bond. As I always say, not necessarily the best Bond, but he is my favorite. And I some of these are better than others, there's no doubt, but but he is so likable. Pierce Brosnan is to me one of the most likable actors around. And going all the way back to Remington Steele and Noble House, that I just enjoy the movies just because I enjoy seeing him run around and do crazy stuff as James Bond. So much more than, say, Timothy Dalton, who I fall asleep watching run around and do stuff. So tonight we'll be looking at 1995's GoldenEye, 1997's Tomorrow Never Dies, 1999's The World Is Not Enough, and 2002's Die Another Day. All right, so I guess without further ado, let's go ahead and get into 1995. Now, to set this up, what had happened is kind of a complicated situation, and I'm going to lay it out as best I can. If you know anything different, John, by all means, chime in, and we'll see if we can kind of lay out what happened. When last we talked, we were looking at the 1989 second of the two Timothy Dalton films, License to Kill. Dalton was under a 3-movie contract. He was supposed to come back for at least one more, probably in 1991. But a couple of things happened. Well, one thing that happened was the Cold War ended, and so Bond films were going to be different. And in fact, there were some people that thought the Bond series should have either ended with the Cold War, or it should have become a period piece set back in the 60s, which, by the way, I wouldn't have had a problem with. I've always wanted a series.
No, that would be cool.
I would like a second series of Bond films every other couple of years that are set back like Mad Men, you know, back in the Sean Connery era. But anyway, so what happened was there was just about like what happened after the first couple of of Daniel Craig movies, there were problems with the studio and the rights and all that. And so when that happened, they had a long delay while they sorted everything out from 89 to 95, the longest delay in the series before or since. 6 years, yeah. And during that time, Dalton's contract ran out. It expired. And they asked him to come back, and he just said at that point, no, he didn't want to. And I say, thank you. I appreciate that, Timothy. I'm glad you did your two. I appreciate you falling on your sword there and letting somebody else take over. Now, we talked about this before, that what had happened was Brosnan was the actor that they liked. I think they saw him on the set of when he was younger, on the set of For Your Eyes Only, where his wife at the time, Cassandra Harris, was playing the Countess, Liesel. And I think that at the time, Cubby Broccoli said, you know, that's my guy in the future. One day I want him to be Bond. And so they had their eye on Pierce Brosnan for a long time. But between the rights getting messed up and then when they cast him officially, NBC invoked their contract on him to bring him back to Remington Steele, and he wasn't able to do it. So Brosnan was kind of on hold for years and years while everything was getting sorted out, both with his contract and with the studios to actually make another movie. Finally, and in a way, I'm almost glad this happened, because finally in 1995,
when the world is the target.
72 hours ago, a secret weapon system was detonated over Severnaya.
And the threat is real.
GoldenEye exists. A radiation surge that destroys everything with an electronic circuit.
You can still depend on one man.
I want you to find GoldenEye.
Three.
Find who took it.
Two.
And stop it.
One.
Name's Bond. James Bond.
The world's most famous secret agent is back.
We aim to please.
And this time, 007 is facing the ultimate enemy. The man who knows him best.
Hello, James.
What an unpleasant surprise.
006.
What's the matter? No pithy comeback?
He was your friend, and now he's your enemy, and you will kill him.
Is the satellite in range?
Target is London.
Now, the entire world is about to be caught in the crossfire.
See you in hell, James.
You first. Kill him.
The pleasure will be all mine.
Did you check her out?
Head to toe.
Three clicks, arms the fuse.
Don't say it.
The writing's on the wall.
Grow up, 007.
I think you're a sexist, misogynist dinosaur, a relic of the Cold War.
You know, James, I was always better.
Both of you, stop it!
You like boys with toys.
Trick is to quit while you're still here.
I wouldn't think of it.
Charming, sophisticated secret agent. Shaken, but not disturbed.
Get us out of here!
Bond, only Bond.
Man just won't take a hint.
I need the gun.
That depends on your definition of safe sex.
On November 17th...
Grab it!
United Artists brings you...
Trust me.
James Bond.
Why can't you just be a good boy and die?
That's one trick I've never learned.
We get the new Bond movie, GoldenEye. It's post-Cold War. It's slicker. It's got bigger production values. I mean, let me flip this over to you now for a second and tell me and give us your impressions in this movie. But start out with this, John. When you think about License to Kill and then you jump ahead to GoldenEye, Do you see what I see, which is a big jump forward in just production?
Sure. I mean, and you'd expect it because of the gap in the movie making, that the movie industry came a long way during that time period of production. But I think there is a big difference. You could see it in the way the movie's filmed, the special effects, the chase scenes and stuff. And I think it's a very sharp looking movie from that perspective.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think of when you think of GoldenEye? What comes to mind immediately?
Well, there's a video game named GoldenEye based on James Bond stuff. It's very popular. But what I think of in terms of this movie is, I think Pierce Brosnan, the first one, really, obviously. And then also I think about, it's the one where they made another one of the 00 agents the bad guy.
Yeah, so that's always a good thing. That's always a good thing.
It's a good thing. So it's Sean Bean. So he's a very capable bad guy because he's a 00 agent.
Yeah.
And he and Bond go back and forth through the whole movie. And there's this whole kind of post-war stuff going on. And then Bond, you know, the GoldenEye thing is basically this giant electromagnetic pulse weapon that destroys electronics, mm-hmm. computers and stuff they want to use. So Bond runs around the world at different points trying to stop him from unleashing that, basically.
I think that the Brosnan ones are all much more high-tech in a lot of ways than what came before. I mean, if you think about License to Kill, you've got the big scenes are like Timothy Dalton hooking a cable onto an airplane, whereas this has got space stuff and helicopters and electromagnetic pulses. And the Brosnan ones all just seem like they were made about 20 years after the Dalton ones to me. Does that seem fair, or am I over?
I can see that. It's certainly the Dalton ones, maybe it's – they're a little – I don't want to say grittier, but they're a little more – less high-tech and more –
Well, they always seem like a movie of the week to me. They seem like a really nice made-for-TV movie, whereas the Brosnan ones to me always seem like major motion pictures.
Yeah, I can see that. Some of it is also, I think, the casting of the other people.
Yeah.
I think in some of these movies, they got really good cast.
Yeah. Well, first up, the title. This is the first one where the title really has nothing to do with anything from any of the Fleming books, but it does have a connection to Fleming. He, in World War II, he was an actual secret agent, and Operation GoldenEye was an operation that he ran that had to do with the fascists in Spain or something. And then after the war, when he bought his little house in Jamaica, we should all have a little house in Jamaica. he called the estate GoldenEye. And so, it was really kind of neat and it fit, right? I mean, it kind of, the idea of GoldenEye, and it's like an electromagnetic pulse satellite thing. I thought that kind of fit, but it was neat that it was like an homage. It still had the connection to Fleming, but it wasn't a story title because they just ran out. There weren't that many. There were still a few left, and there's still a couple left that they haven't done, but they're really not very, appropriate for a movie. They're just not great titles. The joke about the Brosnan run is when they just started making up these ridiculous titles. We joked about it last time. GoldenEye is okay. The next three, though, it's really just like they put a bunch of words in a hat and drew out die and day and tomorrow and world, and they just kind of they just arranged them on a sheet of paper and said, "Oh, Bond 19 will be the die of tomorrow. Will another day tomorrow turn?" but anyway. So the title has a connection to Fleming. The villain of this now. I'm trying to think. There's two villains in this movie, which is kind of cool. Not even to mention the Bond girls and henchmen. We'll get to them in a minute. But there's two villains. There's General Orimov, who's like the really slimy Soviet, former Soviet general.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's Janice, who turns out to be Alec Trevelyan, the 006. That's Sean Bean. Mm-hmm. I thought that both of those they were both good villains. What did you think?
No, I thought they're really good villains. Again, one of the things I think separates these movies, because remember the last movie we had the terrible American guy, Whitaker, it was just awful. And this, I think these guys are much, much better in terms of villains.
Yeah. And the Bond villains go a long way towards shaping how we feel about a Bond movie, I think. And this one really has a couple of good villains. And let's see, the Bond girls in it, you have, she has an interesting name, Isabella Skorupko. Isabella Skorupko plays the Russian sort of computer programmer lady who ends up being Bond's love interest girl. And of course, the fabulous Famke Janssen, who would go on to play Jean Grey in the X-Men, is in the grand tradition of Bond girl names, she is Xenia on a top. And she crushes people to death with her thighs while having sex with them.
Outstanding.
Yeah. I mean, she should have been Xenia over the top because it's a little much, but those are a couple of pretty decent Bond girls. I mean, I think they both are very good in this.
Sure.
And, for henchmen, well, really Xenia on a top is a henchman because she's the villain. You know, this tradition goes all the way back to the very beginning, but you know, memorably Thunderball had the good girl and the bad girl, you know. And Bond ends up kind of messing around with both of them. He has that tradition. And similarly, you know, this one has the good Bond girl, who's the Russian programmer. And then you have Xenia on top is the evil henchman girl, who's also a Bond girl. Now, the evil scheme, they get a little more convoluted now once we get into the 90s. Since you haven't seen this in a while, I'm curious, what stands out to you about the evil scheme involved here? Can you even remember what was going on?
No, I told you, I don't remember these four movies as well because I haven't seen them as many times. I mean, when we get to the later ones we're going to talk about tonight, I can tell you I've only seen them once. But they were going to use the GoldenEye weapon somehow to steal money, I think. But I'm not sure how they were going to do that.
But. Yeah. There's several interrelated plots, and as best I can remember it, Trevelyan had been a Cossack, from a Cossack family that worked with the Nazis, collaborated, and so he hated the British, and he was a 00 agent, but still wanted to get revenge on Britain. Kind of like the same thing as in Skyfall, in a way, or similar to the villain in Skyfall. And so he was going to rob a bank in London and use the GoldenEye explosion to erase with an electromagnetic pulse, erase all the records of his robbery. And this was tied into the Russians being up to something, and I don't even know. But
it seems a little bit of overkill to use a satellite EMP weapon to cover a bank robbery. But
yeah, and they had two of them, and they used one to cover up stealing the second one. That's why they blew up the base where the programmer lady worked.
Sure.
Now, I got to say, in terms of henchmen, there's one other henchman I forgot, and that's Boris. We had the fantastic Alan Cumming as – it was Alan Cumming, wasn't it? He's not listed on my short.
No, I see him.
Okay. Yeah, Alan Cumming played Boris, the Russian computer hacker, and he's always good in anything pretty much because he can do great accents and he can be very over the top. And so he's the guy that spins his pen around and clicks it. You remember? I am invincible. Click, 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 click. You know, and he gets frozen. but he's really good in it as kind of a double agent. And so it's got that going for it. There's several memorable scenes in this movie. Do you remember? This is the movie where Bond steals an army tank. And drives around Moscow or St. Petersburg. I forget which. I think they filmed it in St. Petersburg. I'm not sure. I guess it's supposed to be Moscow. The Russians capture Bond and the girl at one point, and you have the spiritual heir of General Gogol, that we've talked about before, the good Russian, you know. He's the defense minister or whatever, but he's a fairly nice guy, but he and Bond are arguing and yelling at each other and accusing each other of stuff, and Isabella Skorupko says, "Stop it! You are like boys with toys." I thought it's kind of funny. Nice. That she's like shaming them both, you know, for for being silly. By the way, my milkshake has arrived. As our listeners know, I've been getting over pneumonia, so I need all the energy I can get. So my wife has been so good enough to bring me a milkshake, so I'll be enjoying this milkshake as we go along here.
As long as she delivers my milkshake to me.
I'll have to freeze dry it, and I'll send it up your way. Let's see. What else? Anything else from the movie memorable scene wise stand out? What do you recall as far?
The only other thing I remember is that one of the big satellite dish things was in a satellite dish hidden by a lake,
mm-hmm.
and they drained the water out and then revealed it. And then one of the guys like fell down the sloop of the dish, whatever.
Yeah, it was very memorable of You Only Live Twice with the volcano.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
They used I thought this was neat because I watched Cosmos, of course, when I was a kid. And Carl Sagan did some scenes at the Arecibo Satellite Dish Observatory in Puerto Rico. But in this movie, it was actually in Cuba. It was supposed to be in Cuba because it was a Soviet mm-hmm. installation. But it was the Arecibo dish. They did a kind of a combination of models, actual location filming of the Arecibo dish, and some stuff on a soundstage in London. And they kind of mixed it all together very effectively in editing. And Bond and Trevelyan 006 have a fight on the antenna thing way up in the air. And Trevelyan falls, and then the thing blows up and lands on him. Because just falling like 1,000 feet and getting crushed is not enough. He has to live just long enough for like 50 tons of metal to fall on him and squish him. And we see his face, you know, at the end going, no! So,
well, and it's Sean Bean. He can't live through a movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you think, oh, wait, he's going to live through this one and be paralyzed or something. No, here comes the 80 tons of metal on top of him. Oh, well, so much for Sean. There are some other good scenes. I mean, there's the fight with Famke Janssen toward the end where she's like on a rappelling cable from the helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
And the helicopter gets messed up and yanks her up in the air, and she gets basically crushed into a tree. And I'm trying to think if and the one other thing we got to mention is we reboot. We get Dame Judi Dench as M.
Oh, that's right.
And she lasts all the way to Skyfall. And we get a new Moneypenny. We get Samantha Bond as Pierce Brosnan's Moneypenny. Interesting. Her name is Samantha Bond. And for those that watch, that may not be realized it, that watch Downton Abbey, Moneypenny from the Pierce Brosnan era currently plays the aunt, the main, you know, Robert Crowley's sister on Downton Abbey. So she's still around. I liked her. In fact, she has one of the best lines, and I don't remember which one of these four movies it's from, but I've got to say it now while I'm thinking about it. She has one of the best lines for Moneypenny in any of the movies. And that's where, you're going to love this if you don't remember it. This is where Bond was at Oxford studying some language. I forget, Dutch or something. Yeah, I think Dutch.
Mm-hmm.
And of course he's, you know, in bed with the teacher. Okay. And Moneypenny calls him to bring him in for a mission. And she can hear him, I think, you know, smooching in the background. Mm-hmm. And he says, well, I'm just brushing up on a little Danish or Dutch or whatever, Danish. And she and Moneypenny says, you always were a cunning linguist, James. Yeah, but hold on. It gets better. Because then she hangs up and turns around and Judi Dench is just standing there with her hands on her hips looking at her like, what? And Moneypenny goes, don't ask. And Judi Dench goes, don't tell. So that was pretty good. A good save for a pretty groaning, you know, line. So this movie did very well. It cost about $58 million, and it earned over $352 million in the box office, which is pretty darn good. James Bond was definitely back. There wasn't going to be any more talk of retiring the series or anything. And I think people generally liked Pierce Brosnan. What did you think about Pierce Brosnan in this and in the rest of them? What, I mean, where do you kind of rank him?
I think he, in terms of as Bond was fine. I think my opinion of him is really colored by the latter two movies, which we'll get to, and how I feel about them. So I think it's tough to separate my feelings for him from my feelings for those two movies.
Right, right. Well, GoldenEye is up in my top five or six Bond movies of all, I think. It's one of my absolute favorites. And it's too bad that in a lot of cases, though, they never get better than their first one. I mean, you know, you can argue that you could argue that Roger Moore never had a better one than Live and Let Die. I mean, you could say that maybe A Spy Who Loved Me or Moonraker or something or Your Eyes Only. But honestly, I mean, Live and Let Die is so iconic. You could argue it was the best. Mm-hmm. Certainly Dalton's first one was his best. I think there's no doubt that Daniel Craig's first one was his best, Casino Royale.
Yes.
So here Pierce Brosnan's first one, I don't think there's anybody that argues that this wasn't his best.
Yes.
All right. Now there are things about Tomorrow Never Dies, which we're about to get into, that I like better than GoldenEye. But as a movie as a whole, GoldenEye is going to be the best one. So let's roll over now to 1997, the same day that Titanic opened at the box office. So it's the only Bond film of the Brosnan era that did not open number one at the box office, though it still made a bucket load of money, and that is Tomorrow Never Dies. So here's Tomorrow Never Dies.
Action stations.
Aye, aye, sir. Sound the general alarm.
The Chinese pilot insists we're inside their territorial waters and he will fire.
An act of violence.
Torpedo, torpedo, torpedo.
It was an unprovoked attack on a ship in international waters.
The promise of war.
And instead of decisive action, all you want to do is investigate.
My goal is to prevent World War III, Admiral.
Now, the world has only one chance for peace.
When will our ships be in position?
48 hours.
And just one man for the job.
Bond. James Bond.
How much do you know about Elliot Carver, 007?
Worldwide media ban. Those newspapers, radio, satellite TV.
There's no news. Like bad news.
I understand you once had a relationship with Carver's wife.
Was it something I said?
How about the words, I'll be right back?
I'm from the New China News Agency.
Looking for a news story?
Could have taken care of him.
Let the mayhem begin. Your new BMW.
Will you need collision coverage?
Yes.
Property destruction?
Definitely.
Personal injury?
Accidents do happen.
Throw up 007.
You seem to have developed a certain attachment.
I get to work with a decadent agent of a corrupt Western power.
I think you've found the right decadent, corrupt Western agent as a partner.
Phase two is underway.
This holiday season.
What the hell is he doing?
His job. The world belongs to Bond.
When you remove Mr. Bond's heart, there should just be enough time for him to watch it stop beating.
I would have thought watching your TV shows was torture enough.
Now you tell me, what do you think of with this one? What comes to mind is like the immediate images and thoughts?
Well, this one, I remember that Jonathan Pryce is the villain. He plays a media mogul, and he wants to create a war basically between Britain and China. And so he, you know, moves like the GPS on a ship, so it thinks it's in in international waters, but it's really not, and it gets sank, and there's all this confusion over where it was and whose fault it is and that who started the war, that kind of thing. And Bond ends up teaming with a woman who's a Chinese agent, and they stop him. And I remember he has this big stealth ship kind of thing at the end that they go on. And I remember there's one scene in particular, a big stunt scene where they're racing around in a motorcycle.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure if it's Hong Kong or where. and but there's like a helicopter, you know, coming after them and like coming down the street, like with the blade tilted over and stuff. And I think at one point he jumps over it with the motorcycle.
Mm-hmm.
At one point, I think he lays the motorcycle down and they go just barely under it too. So
yeah, that all sounds right. I think it's Vietnam, but I couldn't swear.
Okay.
To it. Couldn't all swear right. to it. Yeah, that's let me see. So yeah, 1997, Tomorrow Never Dies. The villain, as you said, Jonathan Pryce, basically he's kind of a Rupert Murdoch, Ted Turner amalgam. It's like they took the head of CNN and Fox News and made him a Bond villain. And of course, his evil scheme, let me just jump ahead to that while we're talking about, excuse me, while we're talking about him. His evil scheme is that he wants to get the jump on every other media outlet in the world by actually causing the news so that he's already written the stories about it before it even happens, which is on the one hand brilliant and on the other hand stupid. You know, it's like the greatest and the worst Bond villain scheme ever. This is not something that Blofeld would have come up with, you know.
But it's also like it's the news, you know. I mean, what is he making money on, the advertising? I don't understand how this is a good thing.
Yeah, he just wants to dominate the world's media, and so you know, he. In fact, it's like the name of his paper is The World Tomorrow or something, and that just basically gives it all away that he's not talking about what's happening today. He's talking about what he's going to have happen tomorrow, whether you realize it or not, you know. So it is, it's a bizarre thing. I mean, like I say, on the one hand, I'm like, yeah, that's kind of an interesting idea. And on the other hand, I'm like, well, that's just dumb. So
on some level, it's a good idea, you know, for a villain. But to start like a, you know, what basically was going to turn into a nuclear war between Britain and China was carrying a little too far, I think.
Yeah, I think it must have been inspired by the Falkland Islands War when the British went to war with Argentina and CNN was just starting. And mm-hmm. CNN covered that war 24/7 because it was all they had, you know. Mm-hmm. And you could look at that and say, I wonder if Ted Turner was down there poking the Argentines. Why don't y'all take those islands back? Let's see what happens. Yeah, you know. So I kind of can see it. It's almost so bizarre that it seems real. So, yeah, Jonathan Pryce, he wasn't the original choice. Do you know who was originally supposed to play the Jonathan Pryce character?
I do not.
Hannibal Lecter. Anthony Hopkins, yeah.
Oh, he'd have been great, too.
He'd have had more gravitas. I just can't take mm-hmm. Jonathan Pryce seriously as a Bond villain. He wants to sell me a Lexus. We can talk. but trying to take over the world, I'm just like, come on. Yeah. I'm not worried about you and your turtleneck and your, you know, whatever.
No, he's not. He doesn't come across as evil.
He's just kind of slimy. He's not really masterminding evil. Like I said, Blofeld would take him out in 5 seconds, you know. Even like the Donald Pleasance Blofeld would take him out in 5 seconds. The Bond girls for this one, though, I have to say, on the one hand, you have who's supposed to be the cutesy pie, bad girl turns good, but, you know, helps Bond and pays the price, which is Terry Hatcher. It was inevitable that Terry Hatcher got to be a Bond girl at some point, because back in the mid-90s, she was considered, you know, one of the hottest chicks running around. So they brought her in. But Terry Hatcher did us all a big favor in this movie. She got pregnant, and so she couldn't continue to film it. And so they killed her off earlier than they originally planned.
I did not know that.
Oh, yeah. She was supposed to be in more of the movie and be like at the end with Bond, you know, in the ever-present smooching in the last scene, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And but see, they had to go ahead and kill her off. And in fact, the henchman that kills her off, I can't remember his name, but he's that creepy, tall German doctor guy.
Yes.
Oh, he was awesome. He's the best thing. Well, he's the second best thing in the movie. But the best thing of the movie got to be even more of the movie because of Terry Hatcher doing us all a favor and getting pregnant. And that would be the fantastic, the incomparable, the marvelous Michelle Yeoh. Michelle Yeoh is my favorite Bond girl ever. because she is a secret agent, just like James Bond. They should have made a Michelle Yeoh, Wei Lin movie. She's Wei Lin in this. Mm-hmm. I would have gone to see it 100 times, a Wei Lin movie where she's the star kicking butt on the enemies of China and, you know, maybe working with the U.S. or Britain or something. That'd be cool. And, she's just so cool because Michelle Yeoh, she was, you know, she was already a big Hong Kong action star. You know, basically, if you're a really good martial artist and you speak English in Hong Kong, you can have a movie series.
Mm-hmm.
And she spoke perfect English. She's really athletic. She's able to do all the action scenes. And so she was a big star in Hong Kong cinema. And then she made Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, which made her an international star. And, you know, so it was just, and she was getting a little older too. So this was the perfect time to use her. She was a big international star, big in China, able to go toe to toe with Bond. And see, because of how it played out with Terry Hatcher, she gets to be the Bond girl that goes off with Bond at the end and rides off into the sunset. And so, I really like Wei Lin. What do you remember about Wei Lin and where do you kind of rank her in terms of Bond girls and allies? Because she's kind of an ally and a Bond girl.
Yes. Well, and I said before, I like Bond girls that are capable and not just decorative or, you know, helpless. And she's maybe the most capable Bond girl in the entire series. I mean, she kicks a lot of butt on her own and she saves Bond's bacon a few times. And, you know, she and Bond have this kind of professional rivalry thing too, where she's capable spy in her own right. She doesn't need Bond. She's trying to get the mission done on her own. So I like that a lot. And I think, you know, they do a good job with her as a character, and I'm fine with it. I thought she was one of the better women in a Bond movie. And I, you know, Terry Hatcher is very attractive, and I was happy she was in a movie at some point. So,
I think that Wei Lin is almost like a combination of Tiger Tanaka and Kissy Suzuki from You Only Live Twice, right? She's both the cute girl that he ends up with, but also the secret agent that has the weapons and everything. There's a scene in this movie in her secret lair in Vietnam or wherever, where like all these guys come in to fight and she just like pushes buttons on her workbench and things pop out of the walls and kill them, you know, like flamethrowers and darts and stuff comes flying out. And Bond is just standing there like, dang, that's pretty cool. Where's Q? How come Q isn't whipping me up something like this? So, yeah. So the henchman, the other henchman, I guess, really, besides the doctor, is Stamper. And Stamper is a pretty boring henchman. He's the big blonde-headed German-looking guy. And he doesn't really do much of anything except make outraged faces as he tries to kill Bond all the way through the movie. He's not particularly memorable. Do you even remember him?
You know what I remember? I remember Jonathan Pryce yelling Stamper.
Yeah. That's about it. Yeah. So that's all I really had to say about Stamper. I think he gets blown up in a rocket explosion launch or something from the awesome. Yeah. You mentioned the stealth boat. And the funny thing is people make fun of that, but that's a real thing. I remember reading like in The Economist or Foreign Affairs or something years ago about a stealth boat. And when it popped up in a Bond movie, I was like, oh, somebody else read that article.
No, but we actually built some of those. It's made out of composite materials and stuff. So sure.
Kind of like the stealth bomber, but a boat.
Yes.
It just seems kind of ridiculous when you, until you really think about it, I guess.
Boats are picked up with surface radar. I mean, it makes some sense, but.
Well, so yeah, there's a lot to like about it. Here's the thing. There's a lot to like about this movie. I love Wei Lin. I love all the action in Vietnam and all that kind of stuff. And they go down the side of the building tearing the banner. You know, they're handcuffed together for a while, and that's always kind of fun. There's a lot to like about this movie, but I think Jonathan Pryce just and Stamper are just not strong enough as a villain combination to really carry it that extra step. You know, I mean, I think this could have been as good or better than GoldenEye, but it just can't quite get over the hump that Jonathan Pryce and Stamper represent. What do you think?
I think you're right at that point exactly. That combined with the plot thing we talked about the media guy. I think those two things together make it a weaker movie.
Yeah.
It's not terrible, but it's not nearly as good as it could have been.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, you can see the potential. It just never quite lives up to it, so it's not quite GoldenEye. But it's still in my top 10, if for another reason, because I just enjoy Wei Lin. Let's see. So we rank it around in there. And it actually did even better. Well, it did about the same as GoldenEye. It made about $333 million on a $110 budget. So a movie that makes $333 million is certainly a hit. But it basically tripled the money it cost to make, which is not what they want. They want to see a substantial return. So that was a little concerning. I got to mention one thing that I forgot. The Brosnan movies all, in my opinion, have great opening scenes. You know, back when we were talking about the Roger Moore movies, Roger Moore's movies, he kept trying to top himself on those opening scenes. There's the parachuting off the cliff on skis. There's the parachuting out of the plane with Jaws, you know. Mm-hmm. He kept topping himself. I think that the four Pierce Brosnan opening scenes are all four spectacular. I'm going to run through them right quick, and you tell me what you think, okay? We'll just do all four of them real fast while we're talking about it. GoldenEye's opening scene, we haven't seen Bond before. We haven't seen Pierce Brosnan. He rappels off that dam.
That's right.
And then goes all the way to the bottom. He goes in. We still don't see his face. And he comes in through the roof of the bathroom. Remember? And the guy's sitting on the toilet and he's hanging upside down and steals his uniform or whatever. And then you get the whole business with him and Sean Bean and General Orimov and his guys with machine guns, and they have to use the fuel tanks or whatever to prevent them from being shot. Remember, they walk across the room, push it in the cart. Right. And then at the end of all that, Bond there's an airplane taking off the cliff, and Bond takes a motorcycle, I want to say, and jumps the motorcycle off the cliff, climbs into the airplane in midair, and flies the plane out of there as the dam is exploding. I mean, touchdown, right? That's pretty good.
It's pretty nice.
Yeah. Okay. Tomorrow Never Dies opening, you have the arms bazaar where all the different terrorists are buying their tanks and missiles and stuff. And Bond is there and he steals a jet, remember, and blows everything up. And then the other jet's following him and he ejects the dead pilot in the back seat up into the other plane or something. I mean, all kind of cool. So that's pretty cool. Okay. Hard to argue that. The World Is Not Enough opening is that awesome boat chase. You and I are fond of the boat chases.
Yes.
This is the one where the money somehow has a chemical that explodes at MI6, and the girl escapes in a boat that set it up, that was watching, and Bond jumps in Q's little black stealth boat and goes flying after her down the Thames, and they end up at the Millennium Dome. And she escapes in a hot air balloon, and Bond is hanging from the bottom of it, and she shoots the fuel tanks and blows up the balloon, and he lands on the Millennium Dome. That's pretty awesome. You get a long boat chase. In fact, originally, that opening was supposed to end with Bond getting in the boat and jumping out the door of the building in the boat. And then you'd have the opening credits, and then it would pick back up with the boat chase. But they just decided to go ahead and put the whole boat chase in the opening credits. And I think, I may be wrong about this, but I think it's the longest opening scene of any of the Bond movies, because you get that whole business with the money and then the explosion and then that long boat chase and then the hot air balloon all before the opening credits.
I believe that.
Yeah.
I can see it being the longest.
But that's a really good one, too, because it's a good boat chase. And then Die Another Day, as we'll talk about at the end here, has I think, the best part of that whole movie is the North Korea DMZ stuff with the hovercrafts.
Yep.
Yeah. So I think all four of those are really good. I mean, I thought they did a good job with the opening scenes of those. So I guess let's talk a little bit about The World Is Not Enough.
Zokas.
Renard is behind this.
His only goal is chaos.
He feels no pain. He can push himself harder, longer than any normal man.
If your instincts are right, Renard will be back. And Electra will be the next target.
By noon tomorrow.
She dies, along with everyone in the city.
Where is she?
Your terrorist is back.
007, I want you to go to Electra. She's taken over the construction of her father's oil pipeline in the Caspian Sea.
M told me she was sending some. Mister?
Bond.
This is an emergency situation.
Who's going to the oil?
The one pipeline the West is counting on to supply our reserves for the next century. Don't make this personal.
I can't do that.
I thought it was your job to protect me.
No hard feelings, Mr. Bond.
It appears that you have been beaten.
That bomb will never leave this room.
Neither will you. Arsene, to be threatened by a man who can't grasp what he's involved in.
I usually hate killing an unarmed man.
I'm already dead.
Not dead enough for me.
Can't you just say hello like a normal person?
First things first.
I've always tried to teach you two things. First, never let them see you bleed.
And the second?
Always have an escape plan.
Who are you?
Bond! James Bond.
Why am I suddenly worried I'm not carrying enough insurance?
The world is not enough.
This was the 1999 entry, and this one is infamous for a couple of reasons. Now, the title comes, this is actually kind of cool. Just like with GoldenEye, they found a title that directly pertains to Bond, but was not the title of a story. Do you know where the World Is Not Enough title comes from?
No.
Finishing my milkshake.
Does somebody say it in one of the Bond movies?
Yeah, in On Her Majesty's Secret Service, we find out. Remember when they're doing the heraldry, where Blofeld wants to be the count, the Blochamp or whatever. We find out that the Bond family crest motto is, I can't think of it in Latin, but it's "The world is not enough."
Okay.
So it's the Bond family motto. So they used that for the 19th Bond movie. And this one was really successful, $361.8 million. That's not bad. It's the villain of this one, though, is very interesting because you get Robert Carlyle, who I love. He's the Scottish actor who plays sort of the good guy, bad guy on Stargate Universe. If you didn't realize it's the same guy, go and watch Stargate Universe. It's a wonderful show that was on a few years ago on Sci-Fi Channel. And Robert Carlyle is kind of like the Dr. Smith from Lost in Space type character, kind of a good guy, kind of a bad guy. Well, he's the ostensible villain in this. But do you remember who the actual villain turns out to be? Or has it been too long?
No, I thought he was the villain.
Well, he's kind of the villain, but he's not the only one. In fact, he's not the one actually calling the shots at this point. It's Sophie Marceau.
That's right.
Remember, he's
a pawn.
He had kidnapped her, and she goes over to his side, and now basically he does what she says, more or less. And she as in several of these movies, she wants to kill M. And she owns a pipeline. Remember, they're building a pipeline through Russia. And,
well, see, this is what I remember about this movie is this is what I remember is Denise Richards is a nuclear physicist.
Yes.
Christmas Jones.
That's it.
And I remember there's something about with Bond and her and the pipeline.
Yep.
And it's got, I remember there was a caviar factory in the Black Sea or something. It was at one part of us have a big fight there. So it's got to be some kind of pipeline from that part of the world. And I remember there's something about nuclear weapons and the pipeline. That's all I remember.
That's about all I remember too. It does have, it has Robbie Coltrane as the Russian, I can't think of his name, but it's not important, but,
Valentin Zukovsky.
Yes. Oh, I love him. He's awesome. He's one of the best things about this movie is Coltrane is the as the semi-evil, semi-good, you know, helpful Bond ally who hates him but still helps him. And, yeah, so you get both the Bond girl and the villain together with Sophie Marceau, which was a nice twist, I thought. She makes a good villain.
Mm-hmm.
And you get – and Robert Carlyle again. And then the other Bond girl is Denise Richards, who, again, it was just like with Terry Hatcher, it was almost inevitable that she would turn up in a Bond film as a Bond girl. But when she does, you kind of wonder, did they have to get her? Did they really have to get her? And did they have to cast her as a scientist? And, you know, mm-hmm. No offense to Denise Richards. I mean, she's cute in it and fun, and she's very likable in a way. But, man, I don't know. Are there any henchmen in this movie? If they are, I don't even remember.
I don't remember either. But Robert Carlyle was good because he has that thing where he has like a bullet in his brain or whatever.
Yeah.
And he's immune to pain and stuff. So.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. They tried to kill him before and it was slowly killing him. And he didn't give a crap, basically.
That's right.
He can't feel pain and he knows he's about to die at any moment. So he's just like doing whatever. They lock M up. It's one of the first times you actually see M out in the field doing stuff. She gets locked up in a jail cell and she's trying to figure out how to break out. And that was kind of cool. Giving her a little something to do besides, you know, sit behind a desk and yell at Bond, call him a dinosaur and a misogynist. And there's scenes on a submarine and, you know, yeah, like you said, the pipeline thing at the end, there's a whole battle inside the pipeline headquarters of the mine where they're digging out and they're slamming each other with chains and stuff. And I mean, it's just, I don't know. This film did pretty well, but it's not the best, is it?
No. I mean, the plot is not good. And the whole idea that, you know, I like that you don't know who the villain is until she, you know, kind of flips or whatever, but it's not a great plot. She's not a great villain. And Denise Richards is kind of terrible as the nuclear physicist sidekick. So the whole thing I think is not great in terms of the,
well,
you know, this oil pipeline plot thing.
Well, too, so. And I, it's having said that, I'm looking forward to seeing what you think about the fourth one.
I'm saving my ammunition for the fourth one.
Yeah, there we go. So, well, you know, if you listen to the excuse me, I am suffering from pneumonia still, folks, so I'm going to be coughing occasionally whether I can. Well, I'm trying to hit the button. I'm hitting the mute button a lot. You're just hearing only a fraction of my coughs. If you listen to the James Bond radio show, those guys, I mean, they absolutely can't stand Die Another Day. So let's talk about Die Another Day.
Magnificent view.
My friends call me Jinx.
My friends call me James Bond.
Now there's a mouthful.
You're a rare challenge, Mr. Bond.
Where you're going, you'll get us both killed.
Let's get down to business.
I take it Mr. Bond's been explaining his Big Bang theory. Yeah, I think I got the thrust of it.
What happened to you?
Bond.
Plenty of time to sleep when you're dead.
So you live to die another day.
The last of the Pierce Brosnan ones. We had to wait an extra year for this one. Now, one of the big things about this one, it was the 40th anniversary of Dr. No, so it's the 40th anniversary of the series. It was the 20th of the Bond movies, and they tried to go back and do homages to a lot of the other movies. And so the thing that people kind of noticed about this one first was Halle Berry in a very similar bikini with a knife outfit to Ursula Andress in Dr. No. You you remember that?
Sure.
I mean, that was kind of one of the ways they were hyping it was, oh, you know, Halle Berry. This was when, you know, 2002, this was right around the time Halle Berry was at a, kind of the height of her popularity. And so, you know, with Monsters Ball and all that kind of stuff. And so, and the X-Men had just come out. And so they were really trying to push that. But they tried to push a few other things, too, that that tied back to the other ones. But what do you what jumps out at you about 2002's Die Another Day?
What jumps out to me is I think this is the single worst Bond movie.
Wow. Wow. All right. Here we go.
I've been waiting to say that since we started this series. To me, this is the worst one. I think I really didn't enjoy it. I don't love the plot. I didn't enjoy the North Korean stuff where he's a prisoner and everything. And I didn't think it made a lot of sense. And, you know, I didn't enjoy watching it. I did not enjoy it as I watched it, and I have no desire to see it again.
You know, it's interesting. I think that with almost all of the Bond films, they start out basic, and they throw more stuff in every movie as if the answer to an actor being on – As if the answer that they turn to for an actor having done several already is, well, let's just have more. Let's do more stuff. You know, and at a point, they finally reach a point and say, let's just throw all that away and go back to basics again. We've talked about this before, right? They go back and forth like a pendulum on this. And, you know, Casino Royale, for example, is how they swung back the other way. Or For Your Eyes Only is how they swung back the other way. Whereas, you know, You Only Live Twice, or Moonraker, or this one are examples of when they say, let's just dump everything in, you know. And so this movie suffers in a way because I feel like Pierce Brosnan's era, they just accelerated that dumping process too fast. In other words, they did GoldenEye. And then they said, now let's dump a bunch. And then they did World Is Not Enough. I mean, Tomorrow Never Dies. And then The World's Not Enough. Mm-hmm. They just kept – they amped it up so quickly that by the time you get to the fourth Pierce Brosnan movie, it's just too much. It's just too goofy, too much going on, too many implausibilities. It just starts getting ridiculous. Now, let's look at some specifics. Well, by the way, believe it or not, unadjusted for inflation, this movie made more money than any other Bond movie up to that point.
There's no accounting for taste.
$432 million.
And I think it's like a lot of these other movies, what else is in the theater at the time? It sounds like nothing, the amount of money it made.
Yeah, whereas Tomorrow Never Dies was up against Titanic its entire run, so it was always going to be second, you know. The interesting thing about this is they were trying to go out of the box a little bit, and they brought in Lee Tamahori to direct it. He had done, I think, some Japanese action type movies, you know. And so he was, again, you know, instead of going back to the same old, you know, 80-year-old British guys to keep coming in and directing them over and over, they got somebody different. And in a way, that's kind of good. But would you agree that this movie almost turns into The Fast and the Furious toward the
Very much. It's much more kind of explosion action, you know, gadget oriented than any of the other Bond movies. And it's not about the people at all in some ways.
And they're doing it all in the car. You know, like they have the whole chase in the ice castle in the car.
Yes. Yes.
Now the villains are kind of interesting. They had a potential. I liked, Toby Stevens and Rosamund Pike as the duo, the nasty duo. Rosamund Pike certainly is very, very likable in her current movie. She's Gone Girl. But Toby Stevens is the British rich guy who turns out to actually be the North Korean colonel from the beginning of the movie who's had gene therapy to look like a British guy.
Mm-hmm.
And that I thought was a little implausible to begin with, just a little bit, you know. Then they have a laser satellite, like in Diamonds Are Forever. Mm-hmm. It's melting the ice. And we have the greatest Bond stunt of all time. And I'm saying that sarcastically, where he actually parasails a tsunami and lands on the ice on his bare feet. There are a few things I like about this movie. I like Rosamund Pike as the sword fighting girl. I thought that Halle Berry was okay as his sidekick, pretty much in it. She's okay. She's not as bad as she could be. I like the North Korean stuff in the DMZ. I'd never seen the DMZ or a fictitious production of it in a movie ever, and so it was kind of neat to see a race on hovercraft through the DMZ where Bond's, you know, being chased by the whole North Korean army that's floating over the landmines and everything. I thought that was kind of neat. And I like that he gets captured and tortured and has like a beard, looks like Robinson Crusoe when they get him out. I thought that was kind of neat. If they could have just kind of kept the reins on it a little bit, but it just keeps slipping away and turning into crazy, wacky, goofyville.
No, you're right. That's where it comes off the track. It gets kind of wacky, and I'm just like,
you get like an extended scene in Cuba that's not horrible, where he's like smoking cigars with his old buddies in Cuba and driving like a 50s sure. Chevy or something. And Pierce Brosnan was obviously very comfortable doing that. I get the sense that Pierce Brosnan likes to hang out on the beach and smoke cigars and drive cool cars, and so that he wasn't even acting, But then you get to the stuff in the ice palace and the laser beam from space and the melting rooms and the car, and the invisible car kind of sums up the whole movie, doesn't it?
Yes. And the other part is they replaced Q with John Cleese by this point.
Yeah.
So that it just shows where they were trying to go with some of that, where it's comic relief every time Q is there. It's not trying to be cool and interesting, is trying to be comedy.
Yeah, I have to agree that I think switching to Ben Whishaw was a good move in Skyfall. Because I don't even remember who Q was before Skyfall in the two. I don't guess
he never had one.
He didn't have a Q, yeah. So, yeah, you go from John Cleese, who, like you say, is just obviously playing it for laughs. If you're going to hire John Cleese, you hope they play it for laughs. Why waste John Cleese if you're not trying to be funny? Ben Whishaw is kind of goofy enough to be amusing, but he's not trying to be goofy, you know? So I think I'm looking forward to where they go with him. So, I guess we should have known that Rosamund Pike was going to turn out to be a villain when her name was Miranda Frost. There was no way a good guy was going to have the name Miranda Frost. That just says villain all over it, doesn't it?
It's true.
I have no idea what the evil scheme was. It involved Madonna and some diamonds, some of which were implanted in the face of one of the henchmen. They end up on an airplane and people are sword fighting, and I don't know. So,
well, I mean, the movie starts at North Korea, like in the DMZ. It kind of ends there too, doesn't it?
Yeah, kind of, sort of. I guess. Well, it's in Iceland where they're where they're having the ice castle,
right.
but they do something on an airplane. I just watched this movie like a month ago, and I can't even remember what was going on in it. That just shows.
No, I mean, they go back to the Korean border at the end.
Yeah,
that's where the plane scene takes place. But the other part does take place in Iceland
because they're going to blow up the mines in the DMZ so the North Korean army can invade. That's what it is.
Right.
They're going to use that laser to clear a path for the North Koreans to invade South Korea. So there's your evil scheme. Conquer South Korea. Stalin's like, did that in 1950. Next. So you rank this one at the bottom.
To me, it's the worst one.
Okay. For me, it's not at the bottom, but it's definitely in the bottom ranks. It's not below A View to a Kill. It's not below Octopussy, though I have to admit, having watched the entire series during the Christmas break, I appreciate some things about Octopussy more than I used to, and this one is dropping down very rapidly and may pass it the next time I watch them all on the way down. So it's in the bottom five for sure, and I hate that. Because, you know, Brosnan's going to get some of the blame for that. And so when this movie comes out, it does very well. They start looking toward 2006, and they call up Pierce Brosnan. I think Barbara Broccoli, he was still contracted on it. He had an option. I think he had a 3-movie contract with an option after that. And they exercised the option to do the fourth. And then they called him up in 2004 and said, we're done. And he was very upset because he wanted to do another one. He had said publicly that he thought that since Sean Connery did six, he wanted to do six. He thought six was a good number. And I would have loved to have seen six from him if they'd found better writers.
See, to me, I hear what you're saying about Brosnan, and I thought he himself was fine. But I think the second two movies he did, the writing wasn't nearly as good.
Right.
And I think that's where it came apart.
Yeah, if they could have just gotten better writers, getting the writers that did the Daniel Craig ones, you know, I mean, if you have a Daniel Craig movie, and this is jumping ahead a little bit to what we're going to talk about in our last installment, but Daniel Craig's stories with Pierce Brosnan having a little more warmth and humanity and humor to him. See, because let me kind of wrap up my thoughts on the Brosnan era. I've been talking a little bit about Brosnan. What I like about Brosnan, it's hard to put into words. I feel like he has kind of that same debonair, charismatic coolness of a Sean Connery or Roger Moore when Roger Moore is being serious. He can do the little funny stuff that Roger Moore would do, but not be goofy with it.
Mm-hmm.
I just feel like Brosnan is right there in that sweet spot between really aloof coolness like Connery and kind of wink your eye, silly Moore, and he's much more likable than Daniel Craig, who's just a robot.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just feel like Brosnan brings together the best of all of them without a lot of the bad stuff, and that's why I enjoy him so much. That's why he's my favorite.
I can see that.
Yeah. And I hate that he only got to do four, and I hate that two of the four were not good. But that's still more than anybody else except the two big guys. Daniel Craig's going to equal him with Spectre, with four. But, of course, Craig is contracted to do one more after this, so we'll see what happens with that. But Craig will end up with five, probably. I don't think he'll stay on after that. He's getting a little craggy.
Yep.
He's getting a little surface of Mars going. All right. So any last thoughts about these four movies or anything specifically about them?
No, just the point you made at the beginning. There's a different feel, I think, to these movies in terms of the production and the, you know, the use of technology, and they're much more movies of their time. I think we moved away from some of the stuff in the Roger Moore ones, you know, what the villains were trying to do in these movies and the way they acted and stuff. And you know, I think the other thing that really came on these movies was Judi Dench. So,
yeah. Yeah, I think these movies really did successfully move Bond into the 21st century. They took him out of the Cold War era and into the 21st century. We had a 90s to early 2000s Bond with Pierce Brosnan that was very likable. We definitely had higher production values. The movies looked great, had great music for the most part. Well, one of them, maybe not so much, Madonna. But overall, I mean, I'm really glad these movies exist, and they're among my favorites, with the exception of, you know, which one. So, all right. Well, that's the Pierce Brosnan era. All we have left to talk about is Danny Boy himself, who has done three so far and one coming. So what we'll do on our final episode, I assume, John, is we can talk about those three. I think there's certainly lots to talk about with them because they are controversial. I've said before that Craig is both loved and hated. There's very few Bond actors whose the opinions run so deeply in both directions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are people that think he's by far the best, and there's people that think he's by far the worst. So we'll have plenty to talk about, and then we can kind of speculate a little bit on Spectre and what we kind of want to see in it and what we'd like to see and what we suspect we'll see and all that. So if you all folks will join us in probably a couple of weeks, we will dig into the last three, I guess 21, 22, and 23, as we go into the 21st century with James Bond. So, well, John, I appreciate you coming on, and I had a good time. I hope the listeners did.
It was fun. Yeah. Look forward to wrapping it up.
We'll wrap it up next time. All right. Well, the Rocket's going to get on out of here for another episode. And so, by the way, be sure to visit www.whiterocketbooks.com. I have a new book out called Cold Lightning, which is a novella in the Shattering series. That's the same series as my Hawk, Lucian, and the Lords of Fire, Sons of Terra, Kings of Oblivion. It's only 99 cents right now on Kindle if you go to whiterocketbooks.com. And, of course, visit the Earth Station One Network, which has a number of fine shows, some of them almost as good as ours. So, so without further ado, the Rocket's going to get out of here for another week. Thanks a bunch, John.
Thanks a lot, man.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.